after fermentation, what we have is like a big soupy mix, but we only want one thing in that soup, and this is the specific protein. So even once the yeast produces casein, this protein, there's then processing steps to try and purify or just like get the casein out, this one component out of the soup that we want.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Eamon Quigley and Dr. Gabrielle Bingerola.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Science, Microbes, and Health, a podcast brought to you by ISAP. I'm joined by my co-host, Gabrielle Bingerola, and today we have a wonderful guest, Abby Thiel. Abby is a food scientist, educator, and project manager of research focused on producing milk proteins using yeast. She earned her PhD in food science from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and later worked as a postdoctoral researcher at Wageningen University, in the Netherlands. She's now back in Wisconsin, tells me that she continues to manage projects back in Wageningen. So Abby, welcome to our podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
So tell us what your current position is and what you're engaged in from a research point of view.
Yes. So right now I'm the project manager of this really big research project back in Wageningen that's looking at, can we produce milk proteins using yeast instead of course, you know, milking a cow. And for this project, originally I was a researcher. So when I was doing my postdoc back in Wageningen, I helped with the research aspect of it. But now that I'm back in the US, I have a project manager role remotely.
This is a fascinating idea. So what is the ultimate goal here of this whole area of research, like the big picture that you're looking at?
Right. The ultimate goal is to take some food products or food ingredients that maybe produce a lot of greenhouse gases or take a toll on the environment, or maybe there's animal welfare issues, or people want like a vegetarian or vegan version, trying to find a different way to produce these foods. So in this case, with cows and producing milk, it takes a lot of land and they also produce a good amount of greenhouse gases. So we're seeing, could we take this over to something that is a fermentation product?
Great. Gabriel.
It's really, really a very, very interesting topic. I'm from Argentina, where our country is a big, big meal producer. So far, I have many, many questions, but I think, for example, in the scale, then we will go in the details. But for example, here in Argentina, our biggest company will use 4 million liters of milk a day to produce 400,000 kilos of cheese a day. But I don't think you are thinking in replacing that. What do you think you can use these milk proteins produced by yeast? I think you're not thinking in displacing the dairy industry, but what could be the value?
Yes. So it could be that we have both very widely available, because I agree it's not like traditional dairies or dairy companies are just going to disappear one day. But I think, you know, it's another choice on the market, depending what people want. And also, so we are right now trying to make one protein called casein in milk. That's like the main protein. But there's a whole lot of other components in milk, right? Like milk is just not this one protein. So this could also just be like a food ingredient if you need a protein source. So it could be milk and dairy products. We're looking into cheese and yogurt, but it also could be like a food ingredient, like a protein powder type of thing.
And from the caseins, because caseins is not only one, are you targeting one in special, all of them?
No. So this is what makes this research so difficult is, like you said, we say caseins, but it's actually four different types of caseins. And this is, I think, why it really hasn't been done, because a different milk protein, whey protein, which is much simpler, is actually made by precision fermentation already. It's on the market in the US. But casein, like you said, it is four different types of casein proteins. And then in most dairy products, these proteins come together and form these micelles, like just like thousands of caseins with salts. So it's a very complex protein to try and mimic.
So from my point of view, I'm equally interested, but I come at it from a completely different point of view, because I look after patients who have difficulties in tolerating milk, but in particular, of course, their problems with lactose, which, of course, you're not going to really affect. What you can deal with maybe are some of the cow's milk allergies that you see to cow's milk proteins, which occur in infants. Is that an area that you're interested in?
So it's not on our docket right now, but I will say the good news is if we made milk from this protein, there would not be any lactose, right? Because we're not producing, so it would always be lactose free. But from an allergic reaction of the casein, we aren't digging into that part yet. We're more looking at, can we produce this and upscale it? Could we sell it as a food ingredient? Like, can it stabilize if there's oil and water in a food, like that type of food ingredient? And then trying to assemble these proteins into the micelles, like I said, those bigger structures, and use that to make cheese or yogurt are like the four-ish sections of our project right now.
So maybe it's time that we should do what Gabriel mentioned earlier, maybe get into a little bit of the detail, and maybe you can take us through the process that you're involved with in getting yeast to form the milk proteins and make them upscale it to even to a production level.
Sure. So the first point is we had to pick like a specific yeast. So there are other people looking into this. You could pick like a bacteria. We went with yeast though. And basically we had to find a way to give the yeast like the directions to make this milk protein, because they don't know how to do that. So we had to insert these directions and then try to make the yeast happy in some type of bioreactor, just like some big tank, which is easier said than done, because it's like, do they want to be mixed? Do they want more oxygen, less oxygen? What do they want to eat? Like all of these different factors to try and make them produce the most amount of this protein. Because you have to think, you know, after fermentation, what we have is like a big soupy mix, but we only want one thing in that soup, and this is the specific protein. So even once the yeast produces casein, this protein, there's then processing steps to try and purify or just like get the casein out, this one component out of the soup that we want. So we had to work on that as well. And then after that, it's these steps where we have one PhD student. He's looking at if just these proteins without assembling them into micelles, if just these free proteins could be sold as a useful food ingredient. So he's looking at foods that have oil and water, or foods that have air and water, and could they stabilize these sort of different materials coming together? And then the part of the project I worked on as a researcher and now a PhD student is continuing this, is she is helping to like assemble these proteins into those larger micelles that we find naturally in milk, because actually it's these micelles of casein that make the gel of like a yogurt or a cheese. They're really important for that like semi-solid texture. So we have to find a way to bring them together if we want to mimic these other dairy products.
You are dealing with a genetically modified organism, GMO. Is there any issue that you can use the product they produce? How is it considered or regulated around the globe?
Yes, so it's different wherever you go around the globe, which is unfortunate. So what I've actually noticed with startups in this location, they will move to the US where this is legal right now, where in the EU, I know a lot of people are working on this legislation and trying to get something through, but it would not be, we could not sell it in the EU right now. The good news is we are taking the protein. So the protein does not have this like edited, you know, the yeast is what is edited. The protein is not, but definitely in the US is where like a market would be currently.
And can you?
Sorry, I was just going to ask you. Yeah, you know, you described it in quite a bit of detail there, all the various factors that are involved in optimizing this process. Did you have to work all those out for this particular process?
No, luckily this is a big project, so we have a lot of help. And just at Wageningen University, which is where I was, I worked with four different PhD students. And so one is like in microbiology working with the yeast. One is simply studying like how do we assemble them into micelles. Another PhD is doing the food ingredient research. And a fourth PhD is doing the yogurt, dairy, food research. So luckily it's a big team.
Are you interested also in whey proteins or only in caseins?
So right now we're looking only at casein, but I know a whey protein several years ago now is made by Perfect Day that is made using this precision fermentation method. So like in the US, you can see this, it's in like ice cream and things like that at the grocery store. For us, from like what is interesting to me as a food scientist is really the casein, just because it's this protein that makes a network in almost all dairy foods. Like it doesn't matter if it's cheese, if it's yogurt, what type of cheese it is, like really like the texture that we're used to is simply due to casein.
I actually was looking at some of your work earlier, and I'm not sure if it was your own work or whether it was your colleague's work, but I saw that you had some work, or there was some related work in an area which is a guilty pleasure of mine, namely ice cream. And you mentioned it there on passant. So tell us about what's so important about casein and casein myosins in terms of the texture of ice cream.
Yes. So many people don't believe this, but actually my PhD was studying like the microstructure of ice cream. And so that is a real thing. You can study ice cream. And actually the lab I was in for my PhD, we studied ice cream and confection. So like we had a great lab going there. For my PhD, actually what I was most interested in was the fat globules in ice cream, because this is a bit different, but fat forms a network in ice cream. And this actually is what gives ice cream like its stand-up properties, like stops it from melting so quickly and collapsing in structure. But actually in ice cream, casein is responsible for stabilizing the fat globules. They go to like the surface of the fat globules and protect them from the water or the serum phase. So anything that has to do with food microstructure, I think is very, very interesting.
Can I be a volunteer in your next study?
So actually she was getting her master's degree when I was getting my PhD, and we had to taste test all her ice creams for her, like this, because she was looking at preventing iciness. Like if over storage, the ice crystals get too big, we start to feel them on our tongue after a certain size. And she was adding like a thickener, a hydrocolloid that was actually able to mask that iciness, which was very interesting.
I'm sure you are quite aware about this discussion about the A2A2 milk that is less allergenic than A2A1. Is there any role for precision fermentation to produce this kind of less allergenic milk proteins?
So I definitely think this will be a topic coming up, and maybe not only like the A2A1 milk, but I think like a broader where we're taking proteins, because food allergies are caused by proteins. So why could we not have a project where we look at, you know, like wheat at different, you know, tree nuts or peanuts? Like, I think this would be a great application to see, can we remove whatever is the epitope or the specific part of that protein that like communicates to the immune system, like, I need an allergic response. I think that would be really interesting research to do.
Yeah, and of course, there are much broader implications here, because as you touched upon, food allergies are generally related to an allergy to some protein or protein moiety. So if you have the potential to produce, say, gluten, which is a modified gluten, but is equally good at producing bread as the native gluten, that would be a phenomenal breakthrough. But getting back to your current work, what stage are you at in terms of being able to upscale this?
Yes, so upscaling is one of the last aspects of this project we'll work on, because we started in about like a bioreactor, a tank of maybe just a couple liters. And we do have some partners in the project. It's like a consortium. So we have some companies that are actually able to upscale it and have bigger bioreactors, but we still haven't made that jump yet. So this is one of our like bigger feats we still have coming up, because as you upscale, things start to change, or you don't have the yeast as happy as they used to be. So this is something we're still working on.
You're getting to, I suppose, what we asked you originally, how far away are you from actually creating a new milk, if you know what I mean?
That's interesting. So I think with a new milk, maybe a couple of years, just because we have the casein, but we need to, like you said, upscale it so that it's not super, super expensive. And then we'd also need to make sure we add like the other components of milk, because we can't just have this casein in water. We'd have to find, you know, produce a product with the other like food ingredients and make sure it was safe and stable and that type of thing. So I think that's a couple years away, but definitely in the near future.
And I know that to make like any cost analysis, you need to go to the final scale. But do you have any sense how much could this cost compare to the traditional casein? Is there any anticipation, anything that you can say, okay, this is affordable, or this will be, I don't know, if you have any approach to cost estimation?
So we have one partner in the consortium, which is actually Haas Green Academy. So they're going to do calculations for us, not only on the cost, but also like, is it more sustainable than traditional casein? Because that's kind of the whole reason we're doing this. But like you said, I think they have started making calculations, but we're doing it on such a small scale. Like, so much will change in the next couple of years that it's like, how useful is that number? And I also can't remember the number, so I'm not trying to hide it from you, but it will become more clear as we progress.
Along the way, you've several times mentioned about micelles or micelles, and that reminds me of, you know, some fundamentals of GI physiology, where the absorption of fat across the GI mucosa depends on the formation of mixed micelles with bile acids. Is there a similar type of process going on here?
So we have started some initial digestion studies, actually, mostly comparing, is this casein digested similarly or to the same extent as cow's milk? And I know we haven't seen any differences so far, but I think your studies are probably way more specific. We're just doing like initial digestion studies, but so far we haven't seen too much difference between like a control at cow's milk.
So to date, basically, what you've managed to do is produce casein.
Mm-hmm.
And the next step then would be to add this to water and to create the other ingredients, other components of milk to make it into a quote-unquote new milk. Is that correct?
Yes. And we could, you know, one of the things is we don't have to exactly mimic milk. Like we could, you know, you could be a little creative and say, well, do we need to add, I don't know, magnesium or calcium, you know, like to what we have to figure out, like, to what extent do you want to be just like cow's milk? But yes, that is the general goal.
Abby, and many other animal proteins are very, very popular, like collagen, for example. Mm. Everybody's getting collagen supplements. Do you think there is a role for precision fermentation to produce this other protein?
I definitely think that is being worked on, because I have a friend I know in California. She worked at a startup. They were trying to make gelatin. I'm not sure if they were successful, but definitely this is like where it's going. Absolutely.
Are there any product already in the market produced by this technology?
I don't think so. Last I heard about the company that was looking into gelatin, they were going to do food first, but they ended up pivoting to cosmetics because there's less legal issues to hop through that. Like if you're a startup and you're trying to be scrappy and fast, like food, there's a lot of hoops to jump through.
And in terms of producing milk or this new milk, what really contributes to the taste component of it? Is that more the carbohydrate component, or how much does the casein contribute?
So I would say the taste probably comes mostly from the fat. Like it gives like that creaminess to milk, especially if you drink something like whole milk. All in all, proteins tend to not really have a lot of taste in food. It's really like the smaller molecules that trigger our taste buds. So like lactose in normal milk gives us like the sweetness on our tongue. So there probably would have to be some type of sugar or some type of sweetener added to this new version. But I would say mostly, you know, milk isn't that flavorful, I guess I would say, unless there's an off flavor. So it's mostly probably fat giving that creaminess and like just a slight sweetness.
And how about competing with, because if you look in supermarkets in the US now, you've got a whole lot of other soy milk, et cetera, et cetera. Will they be competitors with you, or will you be able to do better than them in terms of taste and consistency, et cetera?
So to me, what I think is interesting about the plant milks is that actually their protein is not as high of quality, at least for the human body. So soy milk, like protein wise, is what I would say is the second best after cow's milk. The other plant proteins, the human body doesn't use them quite as well. So I think one good thing about this is we are making like an identical casein without using an animal. So this would be like a great protein source for people who maybe are vegan or that type of thing. But milk protein, I think, is like a super high quality. And then I would say like plant proteins, soy is the best one. Like rice milk, if you look at it, it's basically just like water. Like if you held rice milk up, which is available in the US, it's like, it's barely milk, I would call it, or juice, I guess, in the EU.
I will move to a little bit to another topic that I'm really interested in. When I saw your profile, I saw you're very active on YouTube. You have like a big channel, 50,000 followers, 200 videos. But I tried to look for you in Instagram, and I couldn't find you. Me, I'm the contrary. I have an Instagram account. They do science communication. It's like 150,000 followers, but I'm not on YouTube. So for people that wants to do science communication, why YouTube? Why Instagram? Why? How was your story on YouTube that you became so popular?
You know, I went on YouTube initially. Well, initially, I thought I would have all these social media accounts. I would just, you know, post. If I post on YouTube, I post on the Instagram, I post it on TikTok. But because it's something...
They are different.
Yeah, it's, you know, and it's like something I do as like a passion project. It just became too overwhelming. And I just was like, I'm just going to stick to one platform because I can't. It's like too, it's just too much. So yes, yeah. And so I started on YouTube and then I started having some success there. So I just ran with YouTube, but I have nothing against Instagram. I think it's also great. It just was like, you know, as your like hobby project, you sometimes got to draw a line.
Where I was going to go as well, because I wanted to ask you about your other career, if you like, which is as a proponent of food science. So what are the messages you're trying to get across with your YouTube channel and with all of your activities in that area?
Yeah, I would say I have a couple of motivations. One is that growing up, I had no idea you could be a food scientist. I found it in like a moment of panic. I was already at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and never heard of food science and didn't know what I was supposed to major in, and just like luckily came across it at the right time. And ever since then, you know, like my life totally pivoted. So I want to share with people, especially maybe kids in high school or middle school, like the careers in food science that there are, because I had no idea. And also I think on social media, there's a lot of myths about food or people talking about food who have no background in food. So I like to sometimes comment on the things that are false or explain like why they are false. So there's definitely like times where I hear like my family say something and I'm like, Mom, that is not true. And then I go make a YouTube video about it because I'm like, if my mom knows I'm a food scientist, if she's saying this, like other people are also saying this. So, and it also lets me teach. I love teaching food science. So it's kind of like it's good for my brain because I have to think like, okay, I learned this at like a really high level, but how could I explain it to like the general public?
What are the most common myths that you come across in your social media work?
So definitely on YouTube, one of my videos that I did not expect to get a lot of views was like raw milk debates. Like I was explaining why raw milk can make you really sick and has even killed like many, many people in the past. It turns out there's a lot of people on YouTube that love the raw milk and do not want to hear that. Do not want to hear about the studies or the disease. It doesn't matter. And, you know, to each their own. Like I don't try to tell people what to do, but I just want to give them like the information to make an educated choice. So that was a video I did not expect to get a ton of pushback on, but definitely the comments have gotten a little crazy.
Let me add one myth I found recently. There are people that they boil eggs and potatoes together. They did like that for many, many years because they want to spend time. I don't know. They do that. And many, many other people, they think that potatoes can get contaminated with salmonella. And I did a reel explain that 10 minutes boiling will kill any salmonella. It got 2 million views, and so many comments, so many people against, and so many in favor, that this was the biggest myth I went on. 2 million views.
It was wow.
But and I agree, food is full of myths.
So in terms of, you know, as a young person setting out in a career in food science, is it becoming a popular area for people to go into? Is it still a challenge to get people to go into food science?
Yes. So I was surprised. I would say a couple months ago, I went back to UW-Madison and actually the enrollment is down in the food science department. I mean, it's always small. So my graduating class had about 40 students in it. And now it's like down to 15 students. And I mean, this is just at one university, obviously, but I still think like people don't really know about it. And actually, I will get emails from like freshmen that are like, I found your YouTube channel and now I'm majoring in food science and I just wanted to thank you because like they, you know, they had never heard of it before.
Well, ISAP actually has a longstanding interest in food. Obviously, as you know, we mainly work in the area of biotics, but we certainly have great interest in the gut microbiome and other microbiomes. And of course, this becomes, when you talk about prebiotics or postbiotics, you're getting very much into the food area. So I think ISAP is another area where we can help to get the message out there about food science. And my own, as you can tell, I'm not a native Texan. I'm from Cork, which is a longstanding history in food science. Mm-hmm. Actually, very close relationships with Bagginingen. In fact, while I was there, we had some joint activities with Bagginingen. So we're getting close to the end of our time. This has been a wonderful conversation. I think we both learned a lot from what you're about the work you're doing. You're fascinated by it. And we'll just give you a couple of minutes, say, to tell us where you think your work is going to next, to your science work.
Yes. So I would say this project about the caseins made from yeast, we have maybe a year and a half, 2 years left maximum. So what we're really trying to do is get the yeast to produce the highest amount of casein and then really optimize like how we purify it. Because of course, the higher, you know, the more they make, the cheaper the price will be. If we can purify it to really high amount percent protein, also, you know, better for when we make food out of it. So it's really just optimizing how we carry out each step in this long like chain of events to make sure that the end product is the most sustainable it can be, the most economical it can be. And you know, each one of those steps on its own sounds kind of easy, but when you have, you know, so many of those steps lined up, it becomes pretty complex.
So Abby, it's been wonderful talking to you today. I'm sure everybody will want to know, how do they find your YouTube channel?
Yes. If you go to YouTube, just search Abby the Food Scientist. Abby is spelled A-B-B-E-Y, but you can find me there. I'm always adding videos. It's super fun for me to share food science with everyone.
Well, thank you for being with us today. And I really wish you every success with your future career. I know that Gabriela is going to be looking on anxiously on behalf of the Argentinian milk industry.
Absolutely. We are very, very anxious to see how everything this field evolves. Fingers crossed. Thanks, Abby. It was great.
You're on a pretty conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much
for having me. It's been fun. Bye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. Check the show notes for links and further information on this topic. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to this podcast so you never miss a new episode.